So I have heard that there is a well-known Chinese curse that goes like this. May you live in interesting times. Now, what, as I was just speaking with this young woman, what are interesting times? Well, I think we're living in interesting times, because the way I see it, the forces that are loose in the world today, the tumultuous economic changes and social changes and political changes on a sociological changes, environmental changes on both a personal, a community, and an international scale is phenomenal. Can it be denied? It cannot. And these forces are tumultuous, and they move us about, they jerk us around willy-nilly. And we're left to do the best we can. And it's clear that we cannot control the forces that move us personally, our society, and internationally. We can't control them. The best we can do is try to ride the waves of the tumult that occurs. And so there's a constant fluxing and toing and froing and changing of conditions in our life that we have to somehow adapt to and do the best we can with. That's what I call interesting times. Now, why is that a curse? Because for many of us, we like excitement. We like, you know, kind of being on the edge or playing the edge or whatever. And so what's the difference between excitement and interesting? What I am understanding by this being a curse is that the inevitable vicissitudes of life, the fact that we want to experience pleasure but often experience pain, the fact that we want to live with a sense of abundance, economically, personally, otherwise, and often experience a sense of deprivation or loss. The fact that we want to be praised, recognized, praised, acknowledged, but often receive blame, criticism, judgment. And that we would like to be thought well of by our friends, neighbors, others, but oftentimes are not seen most lovingly. This is the way it is. These are the vicissitudes. These are the conditions of life that we all experience. We want pleasure. We do what we can to get and have and enjoy pleasure. And inevitably, the difficulty and the suffering of pain, whether it's physical, emotional, or psychological, comes. We want to be praised, and we do what we can to do our best in order to get that recognition. And inevitably, at some point in our life, it doesn't happen. And we get blamed, or we get criticized, we get targeted. We all do what we can to enjoy the best life has to offer. But nevertheless, the other side of the spectrum, or the other end of the spectrum, inevitably comes. The forces that bring them are not under our control. And while each of us understand this, if I asked you, have you ever experienced pleasure? Yes. Have you ever experienced pain? Yes. Are you making plans to experience pleasure in the future? Yes. Are you making plans to experience pain in the future? No. It doesn't make sense. We're not, while we may understand that it's inevitable, we're really not taking the steps to address the inevitable in our life. Just because we can understand and we know that pain, loss, criticism, blame, judgment is going to come, Even though we know that, we're still not insulated from feeling dissatisfied when it comes. Knowledge alone is not enough. So, this is an articulation of the Buddha's First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth is dukkha saccha, the truth of dukkha, the truth of the unsatisfactory nature of inevitable conditions in life. True? True. We all can agree. We see it. We know it. We experience it. The Buddha wasn't so unique, after all, in seeing that. We too know that. However, what the Buddha did was took the steps, undertook the practices to address or to develop the contingency plans for the inevitable. So what are they? We could say that because change is going to happen and the unpleasant conditions of life will come around and point to us in time, whatever we can do to develop our heart and mind to withstand the inevitable and to understand it in a skillful way and to address it, not just to endure it like a victim, but to address it in a proactive way and in a way that doesn't lead to just fear, depression, suppression, but really is something that we accept in life and thrive on, that is what's required. And the contingency plans for that, or the development of the mind that is willing to do that, is the awakened mind. Because the trouble ahead, while it is inevitable, can be navigated with a balanced, open, understanding, patient, tolerant, loving, generous, kind, compassionate, truthful mind. But these qualities are the mind that is free, temporarily, partially, of greed, hatred, and delusion, or attachment, aversion, and confusion. Think for a minute of someone you know historically or personally in your life, or someone on the national or international scene that you consider to be a good human being. Just someone who's a good human being. And, you know, historically you might think of, you know, Martin Luther King and the courage he had to face the overt discrimination in the States, or maybe Mother Teresa, the compassion she had for locating, finding, and caring for the dying in their last day or two of life in Calcutta, or contemporarily Aung San Suu Kyi, who's still under house arrest in Burma, for wishing for her kinfolk, the Burmese, to have some economic and political expression. Or maybe you know someone in your life that you work with or neighborhood that's kind, understanding, patient. If I surveyed all of you and said, well, now what is it about that person that makes you think of them as a good human being? We would think of, oh, they're kind, they're understanding, they're generous, they're loving, they're patient, they're truthful, they're honest, they have integrity, they're steadfast, they're... Well, all of these qualities are the qualities that are left in the mind when the mind is free of attachment, aversion, and confusion. These qualities in the teachings of the Buddha are called the paramis. The paramis are the forces of purity in the mind, when the mind is pure of attachment, aversion, and confusion, then these are the qualities that come to the fore in the mind. And the Buddha is called the awakened one. And that means one who is awake to, one who is aware of the way things are, who is free of attachment, aversion, and confusion. And what that means is that in order to awaken, the Buddha perfected these qualities of mind to such a degree that they became the default setting of the mind. Meaning, in a challenging situation, truthfulness and compassion came to the front rather than judgment and aversion. When confronted with need or loss, generosity was the spontaneous arising, an immediate arising of the mind. It was the default setting of the mind. Well, imagine what it would take in your life to make generosity, compassion, understanding, patience, truthfulness, steadfastness the default setting of your mind. That's the work. That's the work that's required of us to prepare our minds, our hearts, for the inevitable. And to the extent that we develop these qualities of mind in times of less stress, if you will, times of abundance and times of good health and good harmony within our families and communities, to the extent that we develop it during the easy times, those qualities will be available to us in the difficult times. Now, all of us, or what I'm speaking about is other paramis, these qualities of mind that arise to the fore when the mind is free. And all of us see in our own life that we're generous. We've all been generous. We've all been loving. We've all been patient. We've all been truthful. We've all been understanding. We've all been energetic. We've all been resolute and steadfast at different times in our life. But we also can acknowledge that there's room for improvement. Because sometimes we're not that way. You know, sometimes we'd rather be kind of petty and critical and kind of, you know, somehow we think that's going to feel good. And while these qualities of mind are potentially accessible in the mind, they're not yet developed. And it's only through knowing and acknowledging these potentials in the mind and learning the skillful means for developing them and then making the effort, taking the opportunity to cultivate them, develop them, that we can confront our cultural conditioning that keeps them at bay. Because let's face it, growing up in our families and in our culture, among our peers, we didn't learn how to be loving, kind, generous, truthful, resolute all the time. And so our conditioning through family and culture and peers and whatever is to tolerate something else. To give you an example, in our culture, in our society, we are conditioned to accept deception. It is just, it's rife, it's just pervasive in our culture, deception, whether it's in advertising or political statements or personal relationships or whatever. It's just pervasive in our life. And we have learned that. And in some way, we tolerate it. And to some degree, we foster it. Well, you know what? That is an a behavior of an unawakened mind. And so to really prepare ourselves for awakening and to prepare ourselves for the inevitable, we need to look at that. We need to confront that cultural conditioning of deception and begin to recognize it in our life, how we either support it, acknowledge it, and even rely on it in our own life. So each one of us has within us the potential for awakening, the potential for being generous, the potential for being loving. And I want to pick up some of the other paramis that I'm not mentioning. Let's see. Oh, and this is so indicative of our conditioning. Did I yet mention renunciation? I mean, it's not one that comes to our mind so easily. And why is that? Because it's not valued in our culture. Renunciation. Consumption is, and renunciation isn't. And so, to even recognize, renunciation is a virtue, it's a force of purity in the mind. It actually, the ability to let go, and that's what renunciation is maybe the one quality of mind that will most serve us in times of stress. Let go. Just let go. Let go of your opinions, let go of your needs, let go of your fears, let go of your obsessions, let go of your habits. Let go. Stop suffering. It's just not high on our cultural value scale. And yet it takes a lot for us to recognize in our life that it is valuable and then to learn how to cultivate it, when to cultivate it, how to first value it, and second, how to cultivate it. So just knowing about the paramis is important, but we need to reflect intelligently about these qualities of mind and to begin to pay attention in our life when they're present and when they're not, so that we can really refine our understanding of how to navigate the terrain of life skillfully. And it's all about paying attention and learning from our experience. You know, I don't remember who it was, but somebody said something like, to continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results is delusion. If you keep doing the same thing over and over, but you're somehow thinking you're going to get a different result. Okay, so if you want a different result, you have to do things differently. So we have to pay attention to our life in a way that begins to show us an alternate way of responding to challenging situations rather than our conditioned, reactive habits of mind. It's all about, I think Rodney uses the term urban Buddhist. Is that it? Is that his phrase? Urban Buddhist. What's an urban Buddhist? An urban Buddhist is somebody who pays attention to their life. What is this? You don't have to go off to the monastery. You don't have to go off to a foreign country. You don't have to go off to a cave. You don't even have to go off to a retreat. What do you do in your life? You get up. You do your household chores. You go to work. You do your work chores. You do your social chores. I hope you all voted this year. There's an option there. And otherwise, it's what we do in life and pay attention to it. Being a Buddhist is about being aware and bringing awareness into everything you do in life. I like that. So by knowing that there is another way of responding in life, knowing that we have this potential, and taking the opportunity to recognize the times when we need these, we can develop another way of approaching challenges in life. But what I have discovered in myself, and I hear it from students over and over again, so I'll mention it, is that while we value honesty. We value compassion. We value service. We value generosity. We value simplicity. We value steadfastness. We don't always make it a personal choice. We value it in others, and we can recognize the value of it in others, but we haven't yet seen how to make it a personal choice for ourselves on an ongoing basis. I was having lunch with the fellow who picked me up, and we were having a discussion similar to this, and he asked, well, what is it that prevents us from doing that? We know what's good for us. Stop being naive. We do know what is best for us. If you're paying attention to your life, you know. And yet, we still often make choices contrary to our own best interest. Why? I'm not going to answer that question. Because you know why. Comfort, convenience, habit, think in that line. Or look in that direction. So, while we recognize the potential to develop these qualities of mind that will really be a resource in the challenging times, the interesting times, making these qualities a personal choice requires something else. First of all, it's important to be able to acknowledge this is the way it is for me right now, or for now. It's amazing how often we want to hide behind or we kind of escape from the present moment by living in some imaginary future, that old Bob Dylan song that says, when I paint my masterpiece, everything's going to be beautiful. When I paint my masterpiece, you know what? You have painted your masterpiece. This is it. We're living it. You know, and if it isn't beautiful yet, well, let's acknowledge that. And the ability to just acknowledge that this is the way it is right now for me, in the body, in the mind, in the environment, in my relationships, in my community. This is the way it is. Because without that honest acknowledgement, and I don't mean appraisal like yes, no, good, better, worse. I just mean this is the way it is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. This is the way it is. Without that, we don't know where we are. We're just kind of floating. We're just in some fantasy land. And so the practice of awareness that brings the present moment into view and acknowledged is the foundation for any kind of growth of happiness in our life. The way to do that is first to recognize that there is this potential within us. And secondly, to make some concerted effort to prioritize it in our life, to prioritize them, and then to practice, to take the opportunity to remind ourselves, here's an opportunity to be patient instead of my reactive impatience. Here's an opportunity to let go rather than insisting on my way. Here's an opportunity to be skillfully honest, not deceptively convenient. And we have these opportunities all the time in our life. Is there ever a day goes by you don't have the opportunity to practice patience? Or you don't have the challenge to let go of your kind of emotional reactivity to something that's going on and just have a more spacious, a little more balanced, a little more understanding of the other person's position. Again, in our society, we are increasingly conditioned and are tolerant of shrill, partisan, end of the spectrumism, I call it, where that's what's expected. You know, to have an opinion, a very solid, fixed, and sometimes the shriller the better opinion, is encouraged. Well, this is not, you know, as you've probably noticed, an effective way of communication. But it's what's rampant. And so we get conditioned by what we see and hear on TV and radio and otherwise. And the value of equanimity, or the value of a balanced mind that can hear, can see, can feel, and respond in a balanced way, is not valued, or is valued minimally. And so when we see someone speaking on a community level or a national level or an international level with a kind of a balanced perspective on things, sometimes they get kind of dismissed as kind of, you know, not strident and partisan enough. So in our own life, we have to look at, do we really value opinionatedness, whether they agree with us or disagree with us, or do we really value the quality of mind that can take in both ends of the spectrum and find a place in the middle that's less reactive and more responsive? Do we value that? Well, we have that opportunity every day. You know, which radio show are you listening to? Which TV program, which news program do you gravitate to? Which one are you most critical of? That'll tell you exactly, if you can be honest with yourself, that'll tell you exactly where you are as to how much you value a balanced, non-reactive mind. But it takes practice. Even though we may understand that we have the potential and we may value it, it takes practice to raise these qualities in our mind, to remember them. Oh, I could practice patience instead of impatience, or I could practice tolerance instead of judgment. But let me ask you this. Is there anything about these qualities of mind, these paramis? I should have had a handout for you so you could keep an eye on them. Generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resoluteness or steadfastness, loving kindness, and equanimity. Is there anything about those qualities of mind that is particularly Buddhist? Are they kind of obscure? Are they American? I mean, they're no more American than they are anything else. Are they so esoteric and kind of woo-woo-wow-wow that they're really not accessible? These are the qualities of good human beings. They're all available to us if we practice them, if we take the opportunity to recognize them in our life, recognize and value them in others, and to cultivate them in the interesting times of life. It is said that the life of the Dharma, or a life of truth, living the truth, is carried on two wings, the wings of understanding and the wings of compassion. Understanding without compassion can be pretty dry, pretty lofty, pretty disconnected from the grit of life. Compassion, the wish for and caring for the suffering of others, can be pretty gooey and ineffective without some genuine wisdom and understanding. And so it is the combination, or it's the balance of compassion and understanding that carries our life and a commitment to the truth forward. What is it that makes these qualities of mind forces of purity? Why are they called the paramis? What makes them? Somebody who just practices generosity, are they practicing a parami? Well, they're practicing generosity, but it matters what the motivation for practicing them is. If we're practicing generosity in order to be recognized as a generous person, is that effective? Well, the person who receives the gift gets the benefit. But we do harm to our own mind in seeking that kind of self-aggrandizement. So if we're doing these for our own self-aggrandizement or benefit, you know, resentfully practicing patience, you know, okay, I'll tolerate this. You know, the other person is not being, you know, kind of hounded with our impatience, but are we doing ourselves any good? Not really. And so it's keeping in mind, as we practice these, the balance between doing this for our own good and doing it for the good of others too. And so as we practice these paramis, the challenge is to find a way to practice so that we have both an immediate sense of well-being for ourselves and for others. Because it's not easy to, let's say, practice patience or truthfulness, non-reactivity. It's not always easy to practice them and feel at the same time a sense of well-being and happiness. Sometimes it feels like something I should do. And sometimes we'll tolerate it with, you know, resentment or maybe some doubt or maybe some regret. Okay, I was patient, you know, or I let go of my opinion in order to reach a consensus, you know. And while we're nominally practicing the parami, this quality of mind, we haven't yet learned how to be happy about that. And that's why it takes practice. It takes practice to learn how to be generous and happy at the same time. To learn how to be patient and happy at the same time. To learn how to be responsive or steadfast, truthful, and happy at the same time. And that's a challenge. And that's why it's practice. We try and, you know, we see the limitations where, you know, we don't feel good about what we did, or we feel resentful, or we feel doubtful, or the other person doesn't really get it. And so we need to try again, and we try again, and we try again. And in paying attention to each of our attempts to cultivate these states of mind, we see what really works. What brings a sense of ease in our own heart and ease in the heart of others? And that's why it takes practice. There's no formulaic prescription. I can't give you a technique for perfecting the paramis. It's only through our own insight, into looking at how is it when I do this, when I speak this way, when I, you know, accept the shame of telling the truth or accept the, you know, let go of the opinionatedness, how is it for me? What is it I have to do? Or how is it I have to hold this in order to not either create stress in my life or to put pressure on myself, or how not to suffer? Ultimately, the goal of practicing the paramis is understanding. Understanding ourselves. Understanding each other. Understanding the fabric of our social life, if you will. And while letting go is the tool for freeing the mind. Happiness, in a sense of well-being, is the result. George Dreyfus, one of the translators for the Dalai Lama at times, says happiness is not kind of just gratification on the hedonic treadmill, but rather it is an enduring sense of well-being. And what he's pointing to there is that while pleasure in all of its physical, mental, emotional, social, psychological, economic forms is enjoyable, no amount of pleasure equals happiness. We've sought pleasure. We've all acquired all kinds of pleasant experiences, and they're fleeting. Happiness is something else altogether. And it's this sense of well-being that comes from cultivating these qualities of mind, this sense of well-being, that endures whether the momentary experience is pleasant or unpleasant. Imagine a sense of well-being that endures in your heart even when conditions are unpleasant. That's the foundation for happiness in our life. And it comes because we're prepared. We have prepared the mind. We have the contingency plans for the inevitable. You know, it's going to come. There's going to be challenges in life. There's going to be unpleasantness. There's going to be pain. There's going to be loss. There's going to be stress. There's going to be all kinds of challenging, interesting events. To be happy, to sustain a sense of well-being during those times that are completely out of our control. We can't control the external conditions coming at us, but we can work with developing the mind that can respond to them and not damage our own sense of well-being. That's our challenge. That's our practice. I find it interesting that all of the practices of the paramis, or all of the paramis, are practices of letting go. You know the Buddha's Four Noble Truths? The truth of suffering, or the truth of dukkha, that there is suffering in our life. There's dukkha in our life. There's stressful conditions. There's pain. There's insecurity. There's vulnerability. Sometimes it's just oppressive. This is a fact. Okay? And then the Buddha said, that's the First Noble Truth. And then the Buddha said, well, why? And he said, well, because we hang on, we grasp, we cling, we're attached to, we get identified with. We're stuck on things being my way. And it's because of that hanging on and clinging and attachment that we suffer. Well, if hanging on is the cause of suffering, what is letting go? End of suffering. All the paramis are practices of letting go. Every one of them. Generosity is, well, not only the letting go of things, but it's also the letting go of beliefs, letting go of opinions, letting go of attachment itself. When we let go, what we're really letting go of is attachment. It might be attachment to a thing, it might be attachment to a person, it might be attachment to an opinion, but it's letting go of the attachment. Morality, or sila, is letting go of the need to obsessively act out our attachment, aversion, and confusion. And we do. I mean, at least I see I do sometimes, don't you? I mean, it's true. Sometimes we just act out because I want to. And can we bring enough awareness to our life to see that this is really what it is? It's hanging on to, I want things my way. And can I let go of that? Renunciation is all about letting go. Letting go of whatever you find yourself attached to, identified with, that's causing you suffering. You know, I have noticed in my life, and I'll just share it with you because maybe you've seen it in your life. I often choose to suffer instead of let go. I'll give you an example. Do you ever get into a little snit with your partner or a friend or your child or something, you know, and you're insisting on it being your way? And as long as you hang on to, I want it my way, who's suffering? Now, the Buddha said, choose not suffering. What is it required? Just let go. It doesn't mean that you don't have an opinion, that you don't know what's right for you and the other person. But you don't have to insist on it, because to insist on it causes you suffering. Okay. Watch in your life when you choose suffering over letting go. You'll see, you'll find it often. And right then, when you finally see, all I can do is let go, and I'll stop suffering, then try it. It's amazing how often I'd rather suffer than let go. It's like, wisdom is letting go of delusion, confusion, and I think it's letting go of naivete. Letting go of pretending you don't know. You know what? We do know. We know what's going on around us. We know what's going on in our own mind. But it's sometimes so inconvenient to acknowledge it. Wisdom is the courage to acknowledge it. Energy is letting go of laziness, sloth, and procrastination. Anybody got that as a habit? Patience is, of course, letting go of impatience, but it's also letting go of insisting on things being my way. You know, when you really want things your way, we often get impatient to have it be my way. Or at least that's what I've seen in my life. Truthfulness is letting go of deception, delusion. Resoluteness is letting go of dissipation of mind. Dissipation of mind is very seductive. Have you noticed? Because it's easier to just kind of fritter away time, energy, commitment, than to actually hold it and to work with it energetically. Loving kindness, of course, is letting go of all forms of aversion, hatred, judgment, impatience. And equanimity is not only letting go of reactivity, but letting go of the need to dramatize the normal. You know what? There's a lot of normal, natural events in life. To make a big deal of it, it's hanging on. Hanging on to some sense of your own self-importance. When it happens to everybody. You know, what makes you so special? Yeah, it's happening to you now, but it's just a natural occurrence in the mind or in the body. And if we can recognize that and let go of the need to dramatize the ordinary, you'll see that the mind is much more stable, much more pleasant to live with when it's more balanced. So these are the forces of purity in the mind, the qualities of mind which, when developed, provide us with the tools, the capacity, the qualities of heart to withstand the inevitable, so that we may live in interesting times with a sense of well-being. Ding. So, there's about 20 minutes before 9. I've heard we have to leave at 9. So if you have any questions, I'd like to try to answer them or entertain them. Or if you have not a question but just a comment, then I'd like to hear that. Or if you don't have a question or a comment, but you just have a word in your mind that's kind of stuck there, then I'm sure I could find something to say about that. So are there any comments, questions? Yeah?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. Build up. It's not like, you know, immediate, taking someone out of immediate danger, you know.
Yeah.
Not like a crisis or anything, but, you know, continuing the same injustice going on and on for a while, you know, that it really is harming a group of people or another person.
Yes.
And how to handle a situation like that. And
yeah.
In regard to this letting go.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. It's a great question. The question is, you know, ongoing injustice, not necessarily a crisis situation, but a continuing and an enduring abuse of someone or some group of people, and how to respond to that in a way that isn't just allowing the suffering and doesn't end in a way that doesn't cause you more suffering. This is hard, partly because when we see injustice, we hurt. And mostly, we want to get rid of this hurt. Because if we don't feel hurt, then, okay. But if we take the immediate response is to get angry at what looks like the perpetrator of the injustice, get angry at them and try to demand or force them to change their behavior. That rarely makes you happy. Yeah. So, you know, when the Dalai Lama is confronted or approached by people who want to do all they can to, you know, help the Burmese, help the Tibetan people, well, Burmese or, you know, to help the Tibetan people. He says, you know what, get your own mind under control first. Because if your mind is in a reactive state of mind as you try to approach solving or resolving a situation like that, you're not going to, if your mind is reactive, you know, it's not going to be very skillful in how it approaches a situation. So, but let's be realistic. There's, you know, infinite room for getting a handle on your own mind. So I think that each one of us has to monitor how reactive we're being and how much energy we have to work compassionately to address the conditions. And it's better, always better to address the ignorance that is allowing or causing the suffering rather than to address reifying a person or a group of people or a politician as the cause for the suffering. But it's always based on ignorance. Some form of ignorance is either causing or allowing suffering to happen. Address that. And then to know when you go over the line and you cease to have a balanced mind and you're more reactive and shrill and demanding, than contributing to the discovery of understanding and wisdom. Yeah. So that's the theoretical kind of overview. But when you get in there and you start working with the suffering or the abusers causing the suffering, then you have to be sensitive to your own involvement in that and know when you have to pull back. To acknowledge to yourself, this is the way it is for me for now, is really important. This is the way it is for me right now. I see the suffering and I can't do anything about it. That's hard, but it's so useful for our own balanced state of mind.
It makes me feel, though, that I'm being an accomplice to the situation if I have to continue working in it, and it's sort of in my jurisdiction in a way, you know, as an employee.
Yeah.
I think,
you know, I hear the word accomplice, and maybe there's some kind of a, what's that word, you know, when somebody, enable, you know, like you're an enabler, you know, you got an alcoholic in the family and you don't confront them, you're enabling them, that type of thing. You really have to look at your motivation, what it is that you're doing and saying, and where is the unwholesomeness in your mind. If there's not unwholesomeness in your mind, then sometimes the wisest action is to not confront or not kind of push yourself against an overwhelming force. If there's an overwhelming force that needs to be dealt with, to beat yourself against it is not skillful. Sometimes retreating is the wisest course of action. Retreating till you can generate, till you can nurture your own energy and your own understanding and your own resources enough to come forward and to confront or to deal with or to address the suffering and the ignorance that's causing it. So, again, it all requires monitoring your own energy, your own intention, your own level of understanding and compassion, and how best to approach. But you know what? There's always the possibility of hope. You know, the audacity of hope, if you will. Was there another comment? Or? Yeah.
Something subtle has happened recently. And so I know I can taste it, but it's not totally happened in terms of letting go with my children. Adoption.
Letting go of your children?
Letting go of my thinking I know best.
You know what's best for them?
Letting go of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's exciting. In the sense that it's opening up like a whole other way of recognizing there's so much more to it than what I think.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's, you know, so I'm holding on to that experience that I had, you know, recently, because I really want to walk with that even further. Uh-huh. And I think that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
You know, there's...
part of it.
Yeah.
Because I could feel, I'm like, it's a surprise to me, by the way. It isn't like a... like I read something, so I'm going to do this, but it's not here. It's just something that emerged, you know, that I could see, you know, that I'm not interested in the outcome. And it's exciting. It's very freeing.
You know, one of the practices that is most beneficial for parents as their children are making the transition, whether it's at 14 or at 44, nevertheless, they're making a transition, is to understand that they really have a package, they have a karmic momentum that is just moving on. And you had a little part in it, a big part, some degree, and the karmic momentum of their life is much greater than that. And to really understand that their happiness or sorrow is not under your control. And you can't fix it for them. You can't make it happen for them. You know, it's really their karma. You can do the best you can to support and encourage and understand and all, but you can't do it for them. And in fact, not only your children, but everybody, especially your partner, if you have one. You know, they are just displaying a karmic momentum. And how can we recognize that and allow it and encourage the best within it? That's our challenge as parents, as teachers, as partners, as members of shared society. And kids, that works the same way with your parents too. You know, they got their own life, you know, and they got their own karmic momentum. You don't have to fix them. Self-importance? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? When we finally realize that we are entirely dispensable, It is really liberating. You know, it's not saying, oh, I want to be that way, but we are. Each one of us in our own life is dispensable. It'll come. Our time will come. Excuse me. Other comments? Questions? Well, if you don't have any for me, I have some for you. Okay.
I was wondering about letting go and whether this is a conscious or willful action or more of a... Because I remember having a discussion with Rodney where he was talking about it being just a spontaneous... something that spontaneously happens in the mind. Like there's a kind of a... I mean, it's such an active verb in a way, letting go.
Mm.
And so the tendency is to think, okay, well, I'll just let go of that thing, but it's more how it manifests is more like a pushing away, that thing.
Mm.
So I'm just wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Yeah. Yeah, letting go that's a good question too, because how do you let go? There's obviously some things or some times when we discover that we're holding on, where we can intentionally let go. I tell this story when I was first learning to meditate. You know how it is when you're first learning to meditate. Most of the time, your mind is still doing its old habitual stuff, and every once in a while, you check in and you notice it and you let it go. Well, when I'd gone to college, I'd studied engineering back in the days before the handheld computers, and everything was done by longhand math, you know, in a slide rule. And so I'd spent years just doing math in my head, multiplying and dividing and, you know, all kinds of complicated mathematical calculations. And so when I sat down to meditate, you know, when my mind would wander off, it would wander off into mathematical computations, and I'd be multiplying out some fantastic numbers in the mind and trying to divide these weird numbers. It's like, and that's where my mind would wander, and I'd see that happening. I'd say, do I need to be doing this now? You know, and by becoming aware of it, I could intentionally just let go. Just boom. Or you find yourself sitting and you're like this, you know, and you discover you're sitting like this, you say, oh, I think I'll let go of that, you know. And so sometimes we can, upon recognizing that there's holding on, we can intentionally let go. But there's other times when we see what's going on in the mind. You know, sometimes you get into, in your own practice or in your own mind, you'll get into an obsession. And you're remembering some argument you had with somebody, and you're just working yourself up into a froth, and you're just upset, you know, either fearful or angry or distressed in some way. And you recognize it and you say, oh, I'd like to let go of this, but you can't. You can't let go. That level of obsession or that level of attachment in the mind can't be let go of by a single, simple intention. You can say, oh, I'm going to let go of being angry. Doesn't happen. You're still angry. I'm going to let go of being impatient. Doesn't happen. I'm going to let go of being fearful. Doesn't happen. And so that kind of letting go takes something other than intention. It takes training the mind. Training the mind so that when wisdom tells the mind to let go, it can. Okay, that takes both concentration or stability of mind and understanding. That's not intention, but that's a cultivation of qualities of mind. So I think I understand what Rodney means, you know, and I'm assuming that, you know, when he says it's just this impulse in the mind, sometimes it is just the recognition and then the letting go. But sometimes it's also just the recognition of anger in the mind and an ability to let go. But that ability to let go comes because of the training of the mind to recognize these obsessing habits of mind and to be able to put them aside. Yeah. And ultimately, letting go involves not just intention, and not just training the mind, but the deepest letting go is letting go through understanding things as they truly are. Because if you understand things as they truly are, you'll let go of delusion. And that's got nothing to do with intention. It's got nothing to do with steadiness of mind. It's got to do with how clearly you see, oh, this is the way things are, and accept it, understanding. And that's a deeper, subtler, a more refined way of letting go. There's another letting go too, but next year. Well, was that a disappointment? No. Okay. No, it's the letting go into the unknown. Letting go of all conditioned phenomena. Letting go into the unconditioned, which in Buddhist language is Nibbana. What's that? Well, they say Nibbana is the ineffable, or the unconditioned is ineffable. Cannot be talked about, cannot be spoken. It has no size, color, shape, form, texture, nothing about it, except it can be realized. But it is only realized when we let go of all known phenomena. Try that. That's where practice is headed, you know. As we learn how to let go, we let go through intention, through training the mind or steadiness of mind. We let go through understanding, and we let go of all conditioned things. Yes.
Is the effort of practice?
Effort of practice.
Mind,
yes.
By definition, painful.
Is the effort of mind to train the mind? Is it by definition painful? No. But let me add that it's not the effort that's painful. It's the discovery of holding on that is painful. When you discover that there's holding on, then there's physical, mental, emotional pain and suffering in that. So the effort is really to become aware. And once you become aware, you will see and you'll feel some pain. Then it's letting go of that through intention, steadiness of mind, understanding, the unconditioned. So the Buddha's articulation of the First Noble Truth, that there is pain, that there is vulnerability, there is insecurity, doesn't mean that it's there because you're making effort. Sometimes people think, why should I just sit here hour after hour, you know, to go on retreat, hour after hour, day after day? Why should I just sit here? It makes me miserable. You know, it's painful in my body and my mind doesn't like it and my mind gets restless. And we think, oh, the paying attention and the trying to meditate is making it happen. That's a wrong understanding. Actually, the pain, the holding, the frustration, all that is already in the mind. And it's already reflected in the body. It's discovered through paying attention. I know that sounds a little bit self-serving for teachers, but nevertheless, it's true. The frustration is already in the mind. Then the resistance is already in the mind. The holding is already in the mind, and it's reflected in the body. You know, we walk around like this, hoping that it doesn't catch us. You know, if we relax, we're going to feel it. You know?
The analogy to physical exercise, then, isn't right. I mean, you know, you've got to exercise to your outer breath so your muscles hurt, and then you're in better shape, but it's easier to exercise the next day.
Oh, let me think about this one. Okay, so is the exercise of the mind towards liberation similar as the exercise of the body towards good health, right? Is that what you're saying? Is it possible to exercise without hurting? It is? Hey, look, I see some people going, there's no universal agreement yet. Okay. You know, pain is an interesting phenomena. What some people will call painful, other people don't think is pain. It may be intense, it may be energetic, it may be unpleasant, but not pain. So it's really in the quality of mind. The quality of mind will determine whether this experience is intense and unpleasant or whether it's painful. So look at the quality of mind. That's really what you're... When you're feeling pain, look at the quality of mind that's occurring at that time. Yeah, even if you're, you know, even if you're doing exercise. You know, when you're doing your exercise or you're running and you're finally... and you're feeling pain. Oh, what's going on in the mind? Important. Important to understand that. Any last comment? Question? Okay. Thank you all very much. I always enjoy coming to Seattle. There's always a good group of people to like that. So I hope it was informative, maybe useful, at least entertaining. Or if not, too bad.